Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.
Appointed as one of the first Royal Literary Fund Fellows of the British Library, Jennifer Potter first came to Virginia to research strange blooms, the curious lives and adventures of the John Tradescants. Her celebrated biography of the early 17th century plantsmen, collectors of curiosities, and gardeners to King Charles I. She has also written novels, works about gardens and landscapes, and two cultural histories of flowers. A longtime reviewer for the Times Literary Supplement, Jennifer has enjoyed writing fellowships at leading British universities and at Hawthornden Castle in Scotland. She's currently a Royal Literary Fund consultant, fellow, and an archaeology ambassador for the Museum of London Archaeology. Her 10th book, and the one she'll speak to us about today, is The Jamestown Brides, the story of England's maids for Virginia. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Jennifer Potter.
Thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. It's wonderful to see so many people here. And it's also terrific for me to come back to Virginia, to Richmond and Jamestown, where I did so much of the research for this book. And it feels like I'm bringing the Jamestown Brides back home where they belong. What's new and different about the book, I hope, is that it focuses on ordinary women leading extraordinary lives. Curiosity drives all the books that I write. I want to know what happens to people, and I want to be taken by surprise. And today I'll be focusing on some of the things that surprise me about their story. I'll look first at the Virginia Company's role in the whole affair, about why it wanted or even needed to send brides to the colony, and how it recruited them and prepared them for their life in the New World. I'll also touch briefly on a very curious parallel story about Virginian Indian maids who accompanied Pocahontas when she visited London in 1616. And we'll then follow the women across the Atlantic to Jamestown and look at what happened to around a third of them whose lives and fortunes I've been able to track. So let's start with the context to the Virginia Company's trade in wives. The facts are quite straightforward. In 1621, the Virginia Company recruited 56 young English women. Now, they were all reputedly young, handsome and honestly educated, and it shipped them to Jamestown as brides for the planters. It actually claimed to have sent 57, but one of them turned out to be a girl of about 7 or 8. She was travelling out with her parents, so I've taken her out of the reckoning. And for each woman who married, husbands were required to spend £150 in weight of best leaf tobacco. So, was this a trade? Now, of course, women had been coming to Virginia since the very early days, since 1608 and the second supply. They'd been coming as wives and servants, but there were never enough of them. There were never more than about, at best, one woman for every 6 men. When Sir Edwin Sands took over the Virginia Company, this is the company's logo, and here is Sir Edwin Sands. He took over the company in 1619 from Sir Thomas Smythe, and Virginia wasn't doing terribly well at the time. The company wasn't doing very well. And what he wanted to do was to rapidly increase the population by sending out more settlers, and also by sending out women who would marry and produce children and would make the men more movable and less settled. That was his plan. So in early 1620, about 90 young women duly arrived in the colony. They were sent out by Sands, and they were going to be offered free, or they were offered free as brides to company tenants. And if you were a private tenant, you only had to pay for the cost of their transportation. Now, we don't have any lists that tell us who these women were. And perhaps it's possible that there never was a list, because the company at this time didn't need any extra money. But all that changed early in March 1621, when King James shut down the Virginia Lottery, which by this time was the company's main source of funds. Because, of course, Virginia then was run as a private colony. King shuts down the lottery because there'd been all sorts of complaints that the lottery was sucking money out of local economies. And this left the Virginia Company virtually bankrupt overnight. And one of the headaches it faced was how to finance a certain Captain Norton, who had, the company had already arranged for Norton to go out, or to come out to Virginia, to re-establish the glassworks at Jamestown. But it found that it, without the lottery, it had no money to pay him. So the company's response was to allow individual investors to treat directly with Captain Norton for his glassworks. And this idea developed into, four different trades. There was a trade in glassmaking, and that was particularly concerned to make glass beads for the Indian trade. There was a fur trading expedition. There was a trade in general supplies. And then there's a fourth trade, which I'm interested in today, and it's a trade in maids to be made wives. I mean, which really is, when you think about it, quite extraordinary. And it's fascinating, or it was fascinating, to read the Virginia Company minutes when they're discussing this trade and the kind of language they use, and trying to put a respectable gloss on what was a trade in human lives and human futures. And the roles for subscribers, because it wanted individual investors to buy into the scheme, even referred to the whole trade in biblical terms. And it refers to the comforts of marriage, without which God saw that man could not live contentedly, no, not in paradise. So the Virginia Company was going to help create paradise over here in Virginia. And the economics of the transaction were clearly spelled out. Minimum investment from individuals was £8, quite a lot of money then, which was considered enough to clothe and transport one woman. In fact, it got its sums wrong, so it soon raised the figure to £12. Husbands were to be paid, were to pay for their brides in best leaf tobacco. Originally set a price set at £120 in weight, and soon raised to £150, which was then valued at £25, which, if you do the math, it's that's more than 100% profit on an outlay of £12. And investors would also benefit from 50 acres of land, which the company was insistent should not go to the husbands who were buying their brides, but it should go to investors, and the land was going to be pooled into a new settlement called Maidstown. And investors rushed forward. Sir Edwin Sands himself put in £40. Shakespeare's patron, the Earl of Southampton, who was then the titular head of the Virginia Company, he put in £48. And the trade in brides eventually raised £800. So a lot of people were investing. I have to say, the trade was more popular than the trade in glass beads, but less popular than furs, which raised £900, and much less popular than general supplies, which raised a whopping £1,800. We know who the women were from these two extraordinary lists that survive in the papers at Magdalen College, Cambridge, in the archives of Nicholas Farrar, whose brother John Farrar, was then deputy or sort of chief administrator of the company. And I salute the English scholar David Ransom, who first recognised the importance of the lists. Lists like these are just, it's gold dust for historians. And interestingly, they read like a sales catalogue, because for each woman, they tell us name, has father's profession. This is the lists at their fullest. They don't give these details for everyone. So father's occupation, domestic skills the women had to offer, and a named guarantor who could vouch for their honesty, which was then a real mark. We obviously can't tell from the lists if the women were handsome, but they were certainly honestly educated. And as many as one in six came from the ranks of the gentry. And those who weren't gentry all had male relatives who formed, it's like a microcosm of middling England. There were bakers, cloth workers, fustian dressers, grocers, husbandmen, saddlers, soldiers, victuallers, wire drawers, watermen, and the lists go on. Three of the women were widows, and the rest had presumably married. The rest had presumably never married, and their ages ranged from, the youngest was 15 or 16. She was a young waterman's daughter called Jane Dyer from London. And the oldest was gave her age as 28. But I do love it when my research catches people out, because I found her parish records. She was called Alice Burgess from, in fact, there were two or three who were 28. But Alice came from Cambridgeshire, and she was actually 31 when she left, and almost 32 by the time she arrived. They came from all over England. There was a good core from London and the surrounding counties. There was at least one from Wales and some from much further afield. More than half of them were living in London by the time they left, and many of them were living in service, with either relatives or with respectable people, respectable Londoners. And living in service was something that you did as a young girl from your late teens into, until you married, because it was a way of gaining skills, gaining a small measure of independence, and you would also be able to put your very meagre earnings of a pound or two towards your all-important dowry. It's clear from the guarantors of the women that company personnel had trawled among their relatives and acquaintances to get suitable brides. And one of them, Cicely Bray, was even related to Sir Edwin Sands himself. And I wasn't able to find her birth records. She came from Gloucestershire, we're told. But I was able to trace the sort of complicated relationships between the Gloucestershire Brays and the Cumbrian branch of the Sands family. And the fellow you see here, I'm pretty sure, is her grandfather. He's called Captain Edmund Bray. I found him in a church, in a beautiful church in the Cotswolds. He was shoved between the organ and the wall. So it was actually quite difficult. And his face has worn away. Quite difficult to photograph him. But he has this splendid ruff around his neck. And that, I'm sure, is her grandfather. And other brides came recommended by company secretary, the accountant, a lowly chap called Robert the Porter, individual investors, and London's great and good. Now, as to why the women should agree to travel, There's no simple answer. Personal circumstances will, of course, have been a reason for many of them. A lot of the women had lost either one or both parents, which, of course, was common for the times. And many had migrated to London in search of opportunity. Economics undoubtedly played a part, because it was just at a time, 1621 is the year they left, when people in England were feeling very poor. There was a combination of rising prices, declining wages, depression in the cloth industry, and very significant hikes in dowries for women of all classes. And there's a comment from the social commentator, John Chamberlain, that England was never generally so poor since I was born as it is at the present, and that was just in 1621. Now, from the women's point of view, the Virginia Company was offering them, offering to find them a husband at a time when all women really had to marry. Society viewed masterless women with alarm, and preachers and the writers of ballads were particularly misogynistic. And this is from a broadside ballad of 1620, so the year before the women left. It's called Fill Gut and Pinch Belly, and it condenses society's views of men and women into these two monstrous animals. And on the left, you see Philgut, whose only diet is good men, and there are plenty of those, whereas poor Pinchbelly can only eat good women, and there are never enough of those. The words of the ballad are even worse. But actually, at this time, securing a mate was becoming increasingly difficult. And the London marriage market, remember a lot of the women had migrated to London. The London marriage market was especially difficult to crack. And most of the women would have liked to have married apprentices. But to be an apprentice, you had to serve 7 years when you weren't allowed to marry. And at the end of your apprenticeship, most young men aspired to marry the master's daughter or a rich widow, and there are ballads about this as well. So though the women who'd migrated to London would have had a particularly difficult time. But might some of the women simply have wanted to get away? There's only one testimonial that actually survives for all the 56 women, and it's for a widowed woman called Anne Richards. She came from, it was written by the church wardens and parishioners of St. James at Clerkenwell. You see the church here. In fact, this is an 18th century church on the site. And they vouched that Anne Richards had lived among them for about 6 years. And they certified that she was a woman of an honest life and conversation. But what's really interesting is that the date of the testimonial is December 1620. So it's 6 months before the Virginia Company was actually looking for brides. And it says that Anne had asked for the testimonial because she was minded and purposed to live elsewhere. So might some of the women have actually wanted to find a new life for themselves? You'll find the testimonial for Anne Richards among the Farrar papers, which also record the frantic preparations that went into getting the shipments of brides ready, because the company only finally decided to send the women in July 1621, and the ships started leaving from the end of August. And there are lots of bills, and you can really realise, you can read how frantic the preparations were. And I especially love the list, handwritten list of clothes that each of the women was going to be provided for their new lives, because it kind of shows the life people had. They were to be given one petticoat, one waistcoat, two pairs of stockings. Oh, and this is an image from Henricus, so these are the kind of clothes that they would have been sent with. with. So two pairs of stockings, one pair of garters, two smocks, one apron, two pairs of shoes, one towel, two coifs, that's you wear that on your head, and a cross cloth, worsted wool for darning and yarn for knitting stockings. And there were also touches, a few touches of luxury. There were a dozen white lamb gloves, which was a traditional bridal gift. And they were supplied by perfumer William Piddock at a total cost of 4 shillings for 12. And for the Atlantic crossing, the company also provided sheets, canvas beds, bolsters, rugs, prunes for the body, and catechisms for the soul. But before we follow the women on their journey across the Atlantic, I want to touch on the strange story of the two Indian women, Mary and Elizabeth. They were Christianized, who'd accompanied Pocahontas when she came here. Well, she was by then Mistress Rebecca Rolfe. She'd married John Rolfe, and the Virginia Company had brought the couple and their young son Thomas over to London in the winter of 1616. She was a great success at court. She was well seated at the mask. She had her portrait engraved, and the family were living at, they started off at the Belle Savage Inn in Holborn and were then moved to Brentford. And by March 1617, she and the family were sailing back to England. They got down the Thames only as far as Gravesend, where she was taken off the ship. She sickened and was buried in the chancel of St. George's Church. At least two of her female attendants stayed on. And the Virginia Company hoped that it would train the women up so that they would become self-supporting. But instead, they became a drain on the company's finances. So the company decided that what it would do would be to kit these two Indian women out. They were, as I say, Christianized as Mary and Elizabeth. And the company provided generous amount of clothes, far more generous than for the brides, ample stores and two servants apiece, and it shipped them off to Bermuda to marry whoever would have them. And the man in charge of their welfare was the accountant William Webb, who also vouched for one of the Jamestown brides. And they were shipped off to Bermuda just the month before, in June 1621, so the month before the Jamestown brides. And the company spent three times as much on each of the two Indian women as it did on the English brides. So let's go back to the 56 young English women who are they set off, a small group of 13 set off by a ship called the Marmaduke from East Cowes on the Isle of Wight. It was a shipment that was arranged by a local merchant called Robert Newland, who was also an investor in Captain Christopher Lorne's plantation in what became, or has become, Isle of Wight County. So 13 brides leave from the Isle of Wight, 36 sail by the Warwick, which leaves from Gravesend, but first of all they have to catch the long ferry from Billingsgate down the Thames to Gravesend, and the much smaller Tiger left from here as well, with just three brides. And the Marmaduke and the Warwick took at least, it's strange, it took at least 3 to 3.5 months to cross the Atlantic, which seems a long time even by the standards of the day. And I would ask you to, that's Gravesend. I would ask you to imagine the conditions that the women must have endured, crammed into this space. It's called the tween decks, and they would sleep two to a wainscot box. And they were crammed in there with stores, with perishable cargo, with guns, and they were cooped up here for most of the voyage. The few women who sailed by the Tiger had a particularly terrifying encounter with pirates, and off the coast of Spain. And we only hear of their safe delivery from a sermon of thanksgiving that was preached before members of the Honourable Company, a Virginia Company, at Bow Church in Cheapside. The date's significant. It's a sermon of thanksgiving for all the wonderful things that are happening in Virginia, and the safe delivery of the Tiger women is one of those things. And the date is 18th of April, 1622, which was 4 weeks after a terrible catastrophe had hit Virginia, and we'll come on to that later for those who aren't quite sure of the dates. But all the brides reached Jamestown safely. Were they shocked by what they found? I wonder. And throughout the book, I tried to put myself, and I hope you, the reader, into the women's shoes, because they'd left a city of more than 200,000 souls that was fast becoming one of the great capitals of Europe. They'd trekked across the Atlantic, they'd reached the James River, they'd spent another 2 days going up the James River. And this is what they came to. This is Jamestown today, and I imagine it's a lot tidier than it was then. And this is one of the early engravings of Jamestown. Remember, from a city of 200,000 people, they come to a place with a sort of triangular fort, guns, a wooden church, a few granary buildings, and barely two dozen houses clustered within and around the fort area. We don't know how the women chose their husbands. They were promised a free choice of the man they would marry, because the company said the liberty of marriage we dare not infringe. And it asked the governor and the council to be like fathers to the women in the choice of husband. But at the same time, it didn't want poorer planters to get anywhere near them because they wouldn't have the required £150 of tobacco. And certainly poorer planters would complain about being kept away from the women. There was the Vice Admiral of Virginia called John Pountis was instructed to collect money from the husbands and who arrived, of women who arrived by the Marmaduke, and a certain Edward Blaney was to collect money from women who arrived by the Warwick. So what happened to them? As anyone researching Virginia's early history knows, we are blighted by the loss of early records. And it's particularly difficult when you're trying to trace women who changed their surnames on marriage, and especially women with common Christian names. And more than half the 56 women were called either Anne, Elizabeth, Alice, or Mary. And Anne and Elizabeth were especially popular. But I have been able to track what happened to around a third of the brides. With its usual optimism, the Virginia Company said that divers were married, divers just means between a few and, well, it could mean a very few, or it could mean many. Divers were married before the ships left for England. And those who didn't find a husband straight away were dispersed around the James River to settlements, and they had to be chaperoned, so they had to stay with married settlers until they could find a husband for themselves. One of the surprises in my research was actually how few eligible men there were. And there'd been a census in 1620 that counted only 222 habitable houses. And of course, a lot of those would have been inhabited by men who were already married. I think the many gentry women would have found it especially hard to find a husband, because elite settlers had other ways of finding themselves a wife. And the women weren't cheap. £150 of tobacco would buy you two houses and 6 acres of land at this time in Charles Hundred. And the cost per bride was also more than twice buying an indentured servant, and you would also be able to claim 50 acres of land for any servant you imported. But what happened to them? Well, for some of the women, the end came brutally soon. In the great Indian attack of March 22, 1622. So this was, remember, the Sermon of Thanksgiving was 4 weeks after this event. It was orchestrated by Powhatan's brother, Opechancanough, in an effort to drive the English out of Virginia. Jamestown itself was spared, but a number of settlements to which the women travelled were especially badly hit. And among those who died at Powell Brook was Cicely Bray, Sir Edwin Sand's relative. Remember, we saw her grandfather with the splendid ruff. Some survived the slaughter, even if they failed to find a husband. And according to a census conducted in 1624, London Taylor's daughter, Elizabeth Starkey, was living in the Jamestown household of Edward Blaney. He was the agent. She's second on the list, Elizabeth Starkey, right at the bottom of the list of his household members. One above, the very final name, was Eleanor, who wasn't even given the respect of a surname, and may have been, and this is only conjecture, one of the Africans who came to Virginia from 1619. And Elizabeth Starkey should not have been there as a servant. And in the house next door, this is the site at the moment, in the house next door, at the home of Dr. Pott, there was another of the brides called Fortune Taylor. Well, she wasn't a bride, she hadn't found a husband, and again, she was a servant. And Dr. Pott is, for me, he's one of the villains of the story. He's supposed to have been a good physician, but a bad master. More positively, I trace the fortunes of three of the women who married, who found husbands and married, had children and settled down. The first of these is she's called Catherine Finch. She was born in the rural parish of Marden in Herefordshire. You see the church where she was baptised. It's right on the borders between Wales and England. By the time she left for Virginia, she was living in service with her brother. Her brother was called Erasmus Finch, crossbow maker to King James. And they were living on the Strand in Westminster. I found him, and there was another brother who lived Temple Bar, and another crossbow maker up St. Martin's Lane. And I found him in Erasmus Finch in court records. He seems to be a rather argumentative fellow, and he keeps getting involved in neighbourhood disputes with a strange bunch of both artisans and gentlemen. And I also found him in tax records. And living close to the Finches on the Strand was a man called George Thorpe, who may have provided the link between Catherine and her future husband. Because by the time Catherine left for Virginia, George Thorpe was the governor of a settlement over here, the settlement of Berkeley Hundred. And he was a deeply religious man and one of the very few settlers to advocate decent treatment of the native population. And he even had a house built, this is before the Indian attack, of course, a house built for Opechancanough. It was a house that the Indian chief was supposed to be so delighted with, especially its lock and key, that he used to go in and out of his house 100 times a day. And the man Thorpe commissioned to build the house was a carpenter, was Catherine's future husband, Robert Fisher, who had arrived here. He's called an ancient planter because he arrived here early in 1911. And he submits a bill for building the house. But despite his sympathies for the Indian population, Thorpe was murdered, was killed in the Indian attack. But Robert and Catherine survive. And they go to live, they settle, that's Opechancanough, they settle in Jordan, it was then called Jordan's Journey, it's now Jordan's Point, which was a very small settlement of just around 15 households. They have a daughter called Cicely, born in late 1623 or early 24, and they ranked around number 4 in the pecking order. But after the census of 1625, I'm afraid the family just disappear from the records. The closest I came to experiencing what life might have been like for Catherine was when I went next door to the Department of Historic Resources here in Richmond and looked at objects that women might have worn. And these are objects excavated from Jordan's Journey, and they date from around the time. And there's this lovely earring dangle, and also a silver bodkin, which would have been worn by Cicely Jordan, the commander or the wife of the settlement, of the leading man in the settlement. And a bodkin was both, you wore it as an ornamental hair in your hair, as a hair ornament, but also it was an embroidery tool. Another of the women, and we have one of her direct descendants here in the audience today, was Audrey Hoare, who was baptised. She came from Aylesbury, in Buckinghamshire, close to London. She was the daughter of a cordwainer, or a shoemaker. And when she came over, she married another ancient planter called Thomas Harris. And they lived, it was then called Neck of Land, Charles City, but they lived at Bermuda Hundred. And her husband, Thomas Harris, went on to become, he probably arrived as a labourer or a workman, but he certainly became one of Virginia's elite. And they had two children. There was, first of all, a daughter called Mary, and then a son called William. Thomas Harris becomes a captain and becomes really quite substantial. Another of the women who found the same sort of husband who could thrive in Virginia's thrusting society was a young woman called Bridget Croft. She was born in Salisbury, or close to Salisbury, in a little village surrounded by water meadows called Britford. It's within sight of Salisbury Cathedral, which you can just see there. And she married a man who came over much later. He came in 1618, later than Thomas Harris. And they too survived the Indian attack. And they go over and settle on the eastern shore. This is from a detail from John Smith's famous map of 1612. So the eastern shore is there, so they settle around there. They go to a place where Bridget has her home. It's called King's Creek. And it's right next to the secretary's land. So it's clearly one of the first early settlers over on the eastern shore. They started out with very little. They had a house, a gun, and 7 barrels of corn, we learn, in 1625, but nothing else. Their daughter, another Mary, was born soon after. And like Thomas Harris, John Wilkins built up substantial land holdings. Which are still marked today. I think it's absolutely fascinating going round communities where these women lived and finding reminders. This is Wilkins Drive, marks the northern boundary of the first of his many land patents. And this is 400 years later, and I wonder how many of us will still have left our mark 400 years from now. It was interesting. He, like Thomas Harris, he becomes a burgess for a short time, and he also becomes a commissioner for the court, but he never learnt to read or write, which is extraordinary. Were the women happy in the lives that they'd chosen for themselves and the husbands they'd found? Of course, we can't know. If you can't, you know, we can't know their private thoughts. But marital gossip that emerges in court records suggests that both marriages had problems. And according to local gossip, Audrey's husband, Thomas Harris, was a notorious womaniser. And in a court case of March 1626, a neighbour repeated the claim that there were 14 women in church and 7 of them were Thomas Harris's whores, which suggests he had sexual relations with half the women in the settlement where he lived. In the Wilkins case, it was Bridget who, it was her supposed philandering. Now, this is only gossip, and one doesn't know whether it's trustworthy, but her supposed philandering surfaces in court records in a case of slander. She's actually not part of the case. It's slander between, there are two married couples and there's a slanging match between both of them. Bridget gets caught in the crossfire when the husband of one of the defendants accuses the other woman of spreading rumours that he'd committed adultery with Bridget, the wife of Mr. John Wilkins, and that in return for sex, Bridget had offered him enough cloth to make a shirt. another curious parallel between the two women's stories is that after both women died around sometime in the early 1630s and the men married again, both husbands made fraudulent land claims on, John Wilkins claimed 50 acres, which should have gone to the investors in the Virginia Company. Thomas Harris actually claimed that Audrey, his wife, had been an ancient planter, which means that she'd arrived in the colony before 1616, which she clearly hadn't, and he claimed 100 acres. But both of the women will have lived long enough to find out what happened to the final bride, whose story I'll tell, Anne Jackson, born in Salisbury. By the time she left for Virginia, she was living in London in a place called Tothill Street. She went to Martin's Hundred to join her brother, who was living there, and she came in the Marmaduke. And Martin's Hundred was one of the settlements that was really badly hit in the attack of March 1622. And at least 70 settlers were killed, and it was thought that Anne Jackson was killed. But in fact, she was taken prisoner by the Indians, taken captive. Of all the Jamestown brides, her story is the one that I feel most sympathy for. It used to be thought that she was released after a year or two, but I think she stayed with the Indians right until she reappears in court records in January 1629. And she will have been worked hard as a captive. It's possible, but this is pure conjecture, that she certainly will have had to adapt to native ways. But I think it's possible she could have formed an attachment with one of her captors, Women taken prisoner were generally not raped, but she may have formed an attachment, may have had a child, as I say, I can't be certain, but she will definitely have had to completely change her way of life and get rid of her English modesty, because as her clothes wore out, she would have had no choice but to dress in Indian fashion. But then she reappears in court records where it's said that after good consideration, Anne Jackson, which came from the Indians, should be sent to England with the first opportunity of shipping, and that her brother John Jackson shall give security for her passage and keep her safe till she be shipped abroad. You know, had she lost her reason? Had she gone native and had to be bundled out of the colony in disgrace? Or had she simply succumbed to the trauma of returning to the sort of loud, volatile, hierarchical English society at Martin's Hundred? I'll end very quickly by asking whether the Virginia Company's scheme counts as success or failure. I mean, certainly the scheme to bring brides to Virginia was never repeated, and within a year or two, the Virginia Company slid into complete bankruptcy and Virginia became a royal colony. I doubt if any of the investors got their money back. Maidstown was certainly never built. I remain disturbed and kind of shocked that while the company continued to demand payment for the brides after the Indian attack of 1622, it never stopped to ask if the merchandise was still alive. But let's end with the lucky ones who found a husband, produced children, put down roots here in the New World. Their lives were undoubtedly hard, but they would have been hard in England too. And they took their chances and survived. And as I said, we have one descendant of Audrey Hall here today, and I met another of her direct descendants, and we had tea at the British Library. Which sounds kind of right. But Audrey Hoare and Bridget Croft and the others who survived, it's ordinary women like these who I think deserve the title of the founding mothers of America. Thank you.
Shipload of brides came in 1619.
1620, in fact. They were organized in 1619.
1619,
yeah.
And of course, they were women at Jamestown earlier than that.
Of course.
But if this was the last time the Virginia Company sent a load of women, how many years would they have, how many times would they have done that? I have a personal reason to ask. Because I am a direct descendant of Mordecai Cook, who I don't know if you know the story of Mordecai Cook, who was one of the planters and lived in the Gloucester area. And he sent word, this has come down through all the things and it's in all the records, he sent word he would not be there to help. He wanted first choice. He was fox hunting and he wanted his fox. He would pay double the of the amount of hogsheads of tobacco in order to get a redhead. And he got a redhead. And every descendant that I've ever met that is descended from him, redhead is running in their family. But I'm just curious, how many years of brides did they send?
I think, I mean, that's a wonderful story. The Virginia Company, of course, went bankrupt very soon after, and Virginia became a royal colony. This was the last official shipment. And as far as I know, there are only the two shipments. There was the 90 brides, and then there were the, well, it claimed 57, but it really was 56. I mean, it had been sending over women of ill repute, and it had been sending over vagrant children, both boys and girls. But I think this was the only organized shipment for which it charged a fee that brought profit to investors. But lovely story. Thank you.
What happened to the Indian women that went to Bermuda?
All we know, and we know of the story from Captain John Smith's writing, and we only know that one of them was married. Now, I don't know, there were the two women who went. I think it's a fascinating story. One of the women was well married, and the marriage was surrounded with, it was something like all the victuals you could imagine or something. So it was clearly, you know, she married, whether the other one died, because it's not clear whether there were two or three. One of the Indian women were was actually quite sick. Now, she may have died, so it may have been three, and the two ones who remained healthy went over, but that's the last I've found out. Maybe it's someone else can pick up the research. Thank you.
No more? Well, you can ask questions.
Oh, there is a question over there.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Well,
you mean the Tenacity exhibition?
Yes.
Yes, I contributed to some of the women's stories are in the exhibition, and I contributed research stories, and I went there a few days ago, and it was actually wonderful to see the research being used in interactive displays. I mean, I write books, but there was a display of, I call them my women, which I really shouldn't. But there was a young boy faced with, and you could follow what happened to about eight of the women, and he was pressing buttons and everything was whizzing around. No, it's a really interesting exhibition. And the Magdalen College, Cambridge, have lent some the original lists. And when I visited, they can only stay open a certain amount of time because of light and so on. So they've been, the organisers have been changing the pages. But when I visited, the page was open at Anne Jackson, which I felt really, I feel quite attached to her. And in fact, this time did also visit the Pamunkey Reservation up on the Pamunkey River, where I'm pretty sure she was taken and lived there. And yeah, it was a wonderful visit. Someone.
I was interested to hear your characterization of Dr. Pott, because my Jamestown ancestor came in 1620 as an indentured servant to him. And I wonder, and he made good. He married ancient planter Mary Bailey, so he did okay for himself. But I'm wondering why you said Dr. Pott was such a bad
okay,
guy.
Okay, yeah. No, thank you. I hope I'm not treading on toes. Remember, I'm not your ancestor. One of the women who were taken captive from Martin's Hundred included a woman called Jane Dickinson, and her husband was killed in the attack, and she was taken by the Indians, and she was actually ransomed by Dr. Pott for glass beads, but this wasn't an act of charity. He insisted that she should work off her debt to him, and that she should also work off the years owed by her dead husband. And she, after a year or so, she petitions the governor of Virginia and asks to be released from her debt to Dr. John Pott, because she says her servitude with him, with Dr. Pott, is little different from my slavery with the Indians. And Dr. Pott has a plaque up in Jamestown Church, and I would like some of the ordinary women to have their plaque up there, as well as the Dr. Potts of this world.
With the conversation about the exhibit at Jamestown, I hope everyone's aware that this year is a celebration of Jamestown 2019, celebrating the representative government, the slaves, first arrival slaves, and the women. There's a lot coming up on the women. I'm currently on the committee of the women for this celebration. There's a new statue down at the Capitol Square that recognizes the women of Virginia, starting then till now. And there will be a large symposium in October on the women and up until this date. And I saw a lot of information in your bookstore about this year's celebration of 2019, and the women's part of it is coming up. So if you're really interested in all of this, you all look for those events and go to them.
One last question.
Does your research show that any of the women went back to England?
Anne Jackson was supposed to be sent back to England. That's what the court case says, that that her brother should, once she's come back from the Indians, he should keep her safe till she can be shipped aboard to go back to England. And I actually looked for her in Westminster, in burial records for Westminster, and several Anne Jacksons were buried in Westminster in the various parishes in the 1630s, but it was a common name, and I can't be sure that she ever did make it back. I suspect, yes, people were traveling back to Virginia, but these women arrived with nothing. I think it's very unlikely that any of them ever got back to England. I mean, the Catherine Finch, who married Robert Fisher, it's possible that family returned to England, but I think it's much more likely that they succumbed to dysentery or illness or saltwater poisoning or whatever, or all the sort of diseases here. So I can't answer absolutely, but I think Anne Jackson may have done, but not the others. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dive into the revolutionary stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers in Revolution Revisited, a podcast from the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.